Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dermot McDonald sitting in for Brendan this morning, which unfortunately isn't as glorious as it was yesterday morning. Our newspaper panellists have been beavering away, picking out their top stories for you. But before I introduce them to you, let's see what's making the headlines today. Taxman Name and Shame at Risk is the lead for the Business Post, which says that tax defaulters could escape being named and shamed by revenue in the future after the European Court of Human Rights found that the practice was an invasion of privacy. Housing is the lead for the Irish Mail on Sunday, which says that Fine Gael TDs are seething at leader Leo Varadkar's vow to take control of the housing crisis, which the politicians blame for the party's record new low in the polls. The Sunday Independent carries an absolutely gorgeous picture of former Fair City actress Jenny Dixon and her husband Tom Neville, pictured at home yesterday with their twin baby girls, who have been in hospital since February, described as their miracle twins, Bella and Capri. They were born to the couple last February after a 3-year fertility battle, and it's an absolutely lovely picture. We wish them well. For the Sunday Independent, the actual lead is a report that Garda Commissioner Drew Harris has delivered a stark warning to the government that new laws to give Gardaí body cameras must include the ability to use facial recognition technology. Hutch verdict, Gardaí poised for more arrests, is the lead story for the Sunday Times, ahead of tomorrow morning's verdict by the non-jury Special Criminal Court in relation to his alleged involvement in the murder of David Byrne. And it's that much awaited verdict that captures much of the front pages of today's tabloids. There are a lot of tributes across all the newspapers today to Mark Sheehan, the Script guitarist. Eugene Masterson in the Sunday World reveals that the band were being lined up to play at the concert for US President Joe Biden in Ballina last Friday night when he took seriously ill. So some beautiful tributes there. It was a huge win for Sligo jockey Derek Fox yesterday, who rode Corrick Rambler to victory in the Grand National at Aintree. But for a lot of the UK papers this morning, it's the storming of the race course by activists. I think about 120 of them were arrested that made headlines today. I think it delayed the start of the race, and I think the Mail on Sunday is claiming credit for it, saying that they infiltrated all of it. But it's certainly, it's a pity, because Derek Fox, that was his big day. So listen, let me introduce you to my panel. I'm joined in studio this morning by John Halligan, former independent TD for Waterford and former Minister for State, Carl Dieter, Operations Manager of the Irish Mortgage Brokers Association, Louise Byrne, political correspondent for the Irish Mirror, who was out and about with Joe Biden all week, and to Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin. You're all very, very welcome this morning.
Thank you.
I want to go first of all to, because it's a big day in newsrooms when the tax defaulters list gets circulated. They get circulated to every division and wing to see who knows who. And it's, I'm going to go to that naming and shaming of tax defaulters, that process might be at risk due to a landmark ruling from the European Court of Human Rights. It was Michael Brennan, political editor at the Sunday at the Business Post, who has the story today. Michael is on the line. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Good morning, Derval.
Look, this has been an established practice going back to 1983 of publishing the list of tax defaulters. Has it been effective?
I think you could argue it has, Derval. The notion of your name being published out there for all to see, for the neighbours to know that you've been caught by the revenue, and that word to go around locally, that's seen as a very, something people want to avoid. And the revenue know it's an effective weapon, and that's why they generally publish all the lists and names and addresses of people on the tax defaulters list in national newspapers. And it tends, as you said, to get picked up and amplified even further than by media organisations after that.
And obviously there's a debate as to whether it's not just something that perhaps the public or journalists are interested into, but for revenue, that compliance nature of it, that they feel there's a public interest to it.
Yeah, it's a very effective stick for them. The notion that you could settle with them if your tax case is not that serious and avoid being published on the tax defaulters list. At the moment, if your case, your tax default is over €50,000, you go on the publication list. But, you know, there are lots of cases below that threshold where if you pay up and settle with them, you could avoid publication. And that's a very useful tool for the revenue.
Yeah, a carrot and stick. Talk to us just about the ruling in Strasbourg. It was actually a case that emanated not from Ireland, but from Hungary.
Yes, a Hungarian businessman in 2016, his name was included on a tax defaulters list in Hungary. Their tax authorities operate on a similar basis to us. And that was that. His name was published, but then a couple of years later, a Hungarian news website put together a list of 3,500 tax defaulters in Hungary, listed them by name and address on a database, so you could click online and find the nearest tax defaulter next to you, including this Hungarian businessman who's not named. And he argued before the European Court of Human Rights that that was an invasion of his privacy, that it had humiliated and shamed him. And he lost his first case, but when he appealed last month, they came out with a ruling that, yes, his right to privacy had been invaded and he's got €20,000 in costs. And effectively, Hungary will have to change how it deals with publication of tax defaulter lists now in future.
Yeah, and of course, Hungary's limit is actually lower than ours. Ours is, what, 50,000. Theirs was actually smaller.
Yes, theirs is 30,000. So there is a slight difference there. At the same time, we've signed up effectively to the European Convention on Human Rights as far back as 2003. It's the European Court of Human Rights that enforces that then to see that members are actually complying with that. So therefore, the revenue have told me that they are reviewing this judgment to see what implications it has. And it could mean that they have to change the law here in terms of how they deal with the publication of tax defaulters, because it would be open, for example, to someone who's named on the Irish tax defaulters list right now or in the next upcoming one to say their right to privacy has been invaded and take a case as this Hungarian businessman to the European Court of Human Rights.
And indeed, we'd probably actually need to bring in new legislation to alter that, because whether it's Irish Ifigul or the fear of having something published in Stubbs Gazette or in widespread media, it's something that we would probably have to act on if we're to comply with this ruling. I know, obviously, the government are just analysing the potential impact.
Yeah, it would require new legislation. The revenue have said they are legally obliged, as it stands, to publish names when those thresholds of €50,000 for tax arrears are exceeded. So it would require new legislation. The Department of Finance, though, is going to take its steer from revenue. So it's up to revenue to come back with their analysis and say, do we need to change as a result of this Hungarian case?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Michael Brennan, we'll let you go. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Carl Dieter, financial analyst, what do you think? Because it's not just a curiosity factor. What do you think?
Well, there is definitely some curiosity factor.
I said it's not just curiosity factor. Of course it is.
The fact that people pore over these lists and it results in headlines means that it leads to stories. It does lead to shame. It does lead to humiliation. And I think that's an appropriate tool in many parts of life that leads us to behave in a better way, is the fear of being judged by others. Equally,
but like,
I think
we're a small country, everybody knows everybody. If this is published in your locality, the impact is huge. And a lot of them, Carl, obviously there are bigger players, but a lot of it is hairdressers, it's, you know, small business owners.
Well, it's not when you're getting to €50,000 of avoided tax, it's not. So let's just be clear about that. Like, we actually are pretty reasonable in that sense. We're not saying if you miss anything that your name goes on the list. Secondly, is that tax law is law. So you've broken the law. So I don't know why there's a sudden contravention of your right to privacy within that. Because if I go out and I, rob a bank, I don't have the right to privacy if I'm convicted of that. So I think that this is basically a case where there's a take on it, which is probably well thought out, well executed. I'm not a legal expert, so I can't speak to the right or wrong of the judgment. But there is a broad societal ethical piece that I think we should look at ways to maintain this regime, because it actually is a positive thing that helps to get results in cases of tax evasion.
Yeah, it's interesting that Emma Hard, Pierce Doherty, Sinn Féin's finance spokesperson, is quoted in Michael Brennan's piece, and he said he believed the current setup was appropriate and proportionate.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple of aspects to this. There's one in that there's a cost saving to be made if you can negotiate a settlement with defaulters. you know, and use this as leverage. So rather than having to go through a whole process with them. The second part is when you alter incentives, the decisions people make change, right? So in economics, we think about incentives all the time and the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. one of the things that people consider when they're considering paying their taxes or not is that reputational damage that will accrue should they be published on this list. So if you take that away as a disincentive, you're going to either have more people defaulting or you're not paying their taxes, or you're going to have to increase those fines to try and balance that that incentive.
John Halligan, privacy is one of the issues that is hotly contested in our own courts and in European courts elsewhere. Is it? Is that kind of going to be the Trojan horse for amending things like tax defaulter lists, or do you think that there is a public interest as distinct from what we, the public, are interested in?
There's two issues. First of all, most people are taxed at source for starters, about 85% of people in Ireland. So you know what tax you're paying and your tax is deducted from your salary. There are errors now and again where you're overtaxed or undertaxed. The tax office will come back to you and you can arrange that. It's the problem. Most of the problem seems to be with self-regulation, where you have to, you're working on your own, or now errors can be made, or you might run into financial difficulty. But from my time as a councillor, a TD and a minister, that the tax office are very good to deal with people that run in through no fault of their own if their business is not going well.
Or they can be sympathetic to people if they can do a bit of
difficulty. But I think there's an interesting point here that we all have to pay our tax, that's it. We may not agree with what we pay, but we have to pay. And as has been said, it is an offence. I'm not too sure it comes under a criminal offence, but it is an offence not to pay your tax. And to be quite frank with you, if you look at the Independent quite regularly named tax defaulters for a long number of years.
These are public documents.
But you're talking about, you're not always talking about small amounts of 50,000. Sometimes you're talking about hundreds of thousands and so on. And you have to ask yourself, like, what right does an individual have to say, well, everybody else can, the small
man. So is it a question of the threshold for you? Like, do you think it should, or should we only be really reserving that kind of name and power for large
scale? I think that
needs
to be discussed, and I think it needs to be put into legislation. I'm not too sure if errors are, a lot of errors can be made around 10, 15, 20,000. And I met people and small business people who ran into that sort of problem. And I'm not definite. And I think that's going to be very difficult to discuss and iron out, if you like, between the tax office, the complainant and whatever, that which would be the government and the system, to say what limit, where do you stop? Is it 60,000, 50,000, 20,000, 30,000? But finally, I'd like to say is that I think that every case has to be taken individually anyway. And the communication has to be with the individual that owes the tax and the person that takes the tax, which is the government. And then a decision has to be made that you deliberately not pay your tax. Was there an error in not paying your tax? If there was a genuine error, not paying your tax, I don't think you should be named a chain.
That's counter, though, to taxation law, because the one precept in taxation and the thing that makes it work is that it's not up to your willful ignorance or lack of understanding.
That's correct.
The tax is due.
Ignorance of the law is no defence.
That is the law. The same as you couldn't say, I didn't know you can't drive 140 kilometres down that road. No, it doesn't matter what you know.
Some people might say, well, actually, the system that revenue have, that carrot and stick and that kind of built-in perhaps empathy towards people are generally struggling. Is there a sense that if you're published in the defaulters list, it's because you haven't been able to work with them?
You would imagine so, and especially if there is mechanisms put in place to help some people try and reach a settlement. But I think it's like Carl and Emma and Michael Brennan said as well, and it says in the Business Post, publication is a significant part of the revenues compliance kit. And I mean, if that is taken away, you would question whether it will be the same number of people that are defaulting, whether that will go up. I think it's interesting that Sinn Féin and Piers Doherty, talking to the Business Post, say that he believes the current setup is appropriate and proportionate. And to be honest, I can't really see any appetite across government to have this change, to not publish this list, especially if you look at who's in government now, the likes of Fine Gael, the so-called Law and Order Party. I can't see them wanting to take away something that proposes and kind of really backs up sticking to the law and following the law.
Emma, is it a threshold
threshold issue. You know, obviously, Hungary, different country, it's €30,000. Here, it's €50,000. €50,000, I should stress, is a lot of money. But really, is it? Because it does capture a lot of SMEs and a lot of people. You know, when I look at those lists, it's often publicans. It is those hairdressers, it's small business. Lots and lots of people whose occupation is company director. But there's a lot of detail there, because I suppose, because you don't want to libel anybody else, there is the name, there is an address, there is all of that material, which makes it, you know, fertile ground, not just for journalism, but also if that's somebody in your neighbourhood, someone in your county.
Yeah, and I mean, there's always threshold effects. You know, if you change that threshold, it's going to change outcomes. And so, I mean, I think what's interesting here is that, you know, there's no political appetite, I would imagine, it seems, to change this, but it may be that we will be forced to do it if this is a European issue. So it may be taken out of our hands.
One of our listeners says, naming people for speeding convictions to murder convictions is okay, so why not for not paying your taxes? Do you worry, Carl, that because particularly around banking, privacy is becoming something a bit of a Trojan horse to kind of push back against publication of information that otherwise would be, you know, publicly available?
Well, I guess I don't worry about it, and I would say that it's also there's cultural elements to it as well. I was the MC of a digital mortgage conference in Prague at the end of last year. And you can get a mortgage in Estonia or Iceland in a day because the government know the mileage on your car. Everybody in Sweden can go and see what you earned. They just go on, pay a fiver or whatever the fee is, and you can look at that for anyone. So the transparency piece is one thing. And I think that we're pretty good on privacy in Ireland. I do like the approach we take, that your privacy is yours. That said, I think where it interfaces with the law, and you have been in clear breach, excuse me, where you've been in clear breach, that there has to be an understanding that you waive certain rights when you break the law, the same as you can waive your right to freedom if you kill someone. So you can waive your right to privacy. There's cause and effect there. And I think that to remove this would be a grave error. It really is an important part of compliance.
Someone says, in relation to tax default, this is not a civil offence, and it's somewhat like not having an up-to-date NCT or something similar, or something that's not a default, not due to mistake or personal tragedy. Said it's not commensurate to shame people nationally in that context up to a certain threshold. I wonder, in this case, in the Hungarian case, is it also a function of the power of data journalism now? You know, in the past, it might have been just a news, but now we can actually go in and digitally, we can geolocate, we can paint a very, very valid picture, perhaps right down to your neighbourhood.
100%.
Or your street.
100%. And I think that's where the kind of the public interest comes into it. And when I was in college, we were told that the public interest is what the people need to know, not necessarily what they want to know. And But I do think things like this are important. And I think it harks back to the last text that you got in about people are named for any other crime. I think if you took away the naming and shaming element of tax default, well, then I think you're opening like a much broader conversation as well. Like perhaps people would see tax defaulters as people who have a lot of money or people who have a lot of power. If you're not naming them, are you creating a classist kind of idea? Yeah. Are you taking that away? So I think it opens a much wider conversation. But I do think, you know, people do have a right to privacy, but that can't be stretched too far either. Yeah.
Is it a question, John Allegan, of degree as much as kind?
It probably is, but there's an issue here that I think it's important to state, that if you're savvy enough, if you have the wherewithal, if you're educated enough in a particular sphere of industry to set up your own business, part of setting up that business and registering as a company is you must pay tax. Mm-hmm. You must know that you have to pay tax. You just can't take in an income and say, this is all mine and I pay my staff and that's it, goodbye, out the door. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I think that... If you have then not paid your tax, well, almost always it's a deliberate attempt not to pay it, because you must have an accountant working your business. If you're paying wages and you have to pay your PRSI and tax and whatever else you pay, overheads and so on. So I can understand businesses going to the wall or having something going wrong where that's the last thing they pay is tax, they try and pay the wages and so on. But you have to ask yourself then, if you've set up that company, you've set it up in an accountancy firm, which I'm not too sure under the Companies Act, I think you must do that. Well, then you have to ask yourself, like, why did you allow this to happen? You knew that by not paying tax, you were breaking the law.
And what really struck me sort of about the ruling and Michael's piece today is the language. So it was talking about shame and humiliation, and in a country that is trying to recover nationally from shame and humiliation around so many issues. I thought that was interesting, the language around it, and actually is, or is that just fair enough if the penalty, if you take the risk, if you get into trouble, if you don't work with revenue, well then the shame and humiliation is just something you have to brave out.
Yeah, the framing of it is interesting and the language used. I mean, you know, there's a question as to whether people who are actually, you know, not by accident, but deliberately avoiding paying their tax, whether they would in fact be that shamed and that humiliated by it. My suspicion is that what they're more worried about is the reputational damage and the ongoing impact on their business or on perhaps future businesses that they might set up. Whereas, you know, maybe the person who has made an honest mistake feels shame and humiliation. And that's why that threshold that we set is so important, as we've already been mentioned by many panelists. You know, the level that we're talking about here is a huge amount of tax to not pay.
Car dealer, I imagine you out with the bell. Shame. Shame.
It's a complete aside, but I think nationally we find it hard to grip to a story and run with it if it actually doesn't have shame and humiliation. I think we've definitely got a fixation with, like, I'm not saying that we're all like 50 Shades of Journalism or some kind of weird, but think about it.
I don't think you should be promoting shame and humiliation as a national asset.
But I'm saying, if you look at stories that stick and that come and that really grip the nation, shame and humiliation tends to be a key part of it. I mean, you would have to accept that that is a piece of it. And it's also a tool for enforcement of tax code.
But I think just finally, there's a risk I think some people will take in avoiding tax that, like, if I can avoid paying 300,000 or 400,000 or huge amounts of tax. Okay, so I'm going to be, then everybody knows you're going to be mentioned in the paper. It's happened for the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Like, 1983, okay, it's going to be anniversary this year.
Yeah, it's going to be something in the paper on a Monday or a Tuesday and Wednesday that I didn't pay 300,000 tax. It's going to take somebody to look down and see such a guy from Dublin or such a guy from Westmead and so on. And I think a lot of them will say, look, well, at the time, they'll take the chance.
Well, it might be worth it for some, getting a lot of text messages in and emails on that. I want to move on, Louise, to Joe Biden, because you were out and about with the US president this week, and there's lots of colour and analysis. One that really, really struck me was Claire Scott's piece in the Sunday Times, which was actually placing it in a much more global and for President Biden, a domestic context. And this was political, it was religious, it was personal.
Absolutely. And I think Claire has a great kind of summation of the week here. Much like myself, she was brave in the rain and Dublin and Dundalk and Ballina all over. So she was on the ground, so she understands well what it was like. But I think she summed it up really well in kind of the first couple of paragraphs. She said, over 3 days in the Republic, he reaffirmed his Irish history, his love for family, his faith, as adoring fans waited hours to catch a glimpse of him. And then he said, no wonder the US president took his final moments on Mayo soil before boarding Air Force One to announce he was going to run for a second term. And I think this is what a lot of people, perhaps cynically, were saying in the lead up to it, and perhaps cynically last week as well, that this is the start of Biden's 2024 presidential campaign. And a way it was to be like, look how well Joe Biden's doing. He can do however many events a day. And he was quite sprightly come the end of it, in all fairness. He had much more energy than I did on Friday night. I have to give it to him.
So one columnist described it, a US columnist described it as the eat, pray, love Irish tour ahead of the, in a hope to get a bounce domestically.
Absolutely. And I think that maybe that was perhaps a good way of summing it up, because I think one thing that was missing was any kind of hard policy angles on it. I mean, perhaps...
Well, you were writing about, what was it like?
It felt like a homecoming, if we were being honest. Like in Ballina on Friday, I've never seen anything like the scenes. There was so much excitement. People were genuinely so excited to see him. The rain in Ballina on Friday and the rain in Ballina and Dundalk on Wednesday, it is just worth pointing out, it was torrential. It was so heavy. People were getting soaked. Daniel Murray in the Business Post had a great line from one onlooker saying in Dundalk, saying, come on, Joe, I want to have me dinner, which is something I found myself saying a lot over the last couple of days as well. I have to say, he was constantly late. Everything was running behind schedule, but that didn't seem to deter people. It didn't seem to annoy people or get people down. So it was really welcoming. But I do think it is worth pointing out that was a lot of it. It was a lot of the homecoming stuff. It was a lot of the Asher, isn't he great? And perhaps there was kind of more critical elements lacking in that. that. Thursday was a political day, and he made a few political points in his address in Oireachtas about the UK.
And made political points in his address in Belfast as well.
In Belfast as well, which I think you would expect given the kind of what's going on up there. But those are only the kind of two hard-hitting events, if you like. I think everything else was, as you said, eat, pray, love, really soft. Now, it's worth pointing out, the Irish media and the American media, we both asked for press conferences with the Taoiseach and with President Biden. Neither of us got
it. Which is wrong.
Which, yeah, and like, and it was, it, believe me, it wasn't true lack of trying, especially with our American colleagues.
Was there an understanding that this wasn't the big political tour? It wasn't going to be the tour where you were asking about US foreign policy or asking any hard questions, was it? Because it was perceived as this, the last cast, perhaps, of the the Irish-American president coming home, and that people step back and respect
that. I think there's a couple of points I'd like to make on that, but people should read my good friend's opinion in the Independent. Shane Rossi says, no point Biden time in Belfast when there's a presidential election to win. He spent 15 hours in Belfast, probably in his hotel for 8 hours. 2 minutes with each of the party leaders and about 15 minutes with Richie Sunak, then off down here.
It was called the bilate instead of the bilat meeting.
It would be naive to think that this was all about coming home to County Mayo, to where his ancestors came from. This is about an election to 32 million people that have Irish ancestry in America and who vote, by the way, most of them, I think, vote Republican, but it's tight.
But Irish America has changed completely since
I think there's another issue here that's missed, and I think this lady on my right hand side brought it up here. And there's a bit of vilification against the likes of Richard Boyd Barrett, whom I don't always agree with, regarding that here's the most powerful man representing the most powerful country in the world coming to Ireland. Rarely happens, once every 10 years, something like maybe four or five presidents. And we don't get an opportunity to talk about the effects that the American policy has on the world. Economically,
I actually heard him. I saw him on Ireland AM, and I heard what he had to say. Where was, though, the opportunity for that?
Okay.
Because, and I'll tell you why, because this address to the joint, you know, the honour of that joint address to the Houses of the Oireachtas has almost sort of become a ceremonial thing. And it was interesting, for those who were protesting, they weren't protesting outside. There was just a very respectful boycott.
I think it was a valuable visit, and all the American industry in Ireland here. And of course, there's 100,000 people employed by Irish industry in America. But I think, as has been said by the press, he speaks about human rights, the dignity of human rights and so on. America is supporting an awful regime, Saudi Arabia, in the war in Yemen, where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, maimed, children included.
So where should that have been challenged?
Well,
I'll tell you where
I think it should have been challenged. They've given $52 billion in aid. Also, Israel have defied 42 UN resolutions on how they treat Palestine. I've been in Israel. I've been in the Knesset. I've met Israeli ministers. I've been in the West Bank. I've met our own two ambassadors in both Israel and Palestine, and that's not being questioned. And one final thing that's not being questioned.
Perhaps in Ireland, though, it's probably because Irish people are perceived to be very disposed towards
Palestine. No, we're strong
Palestine.
Supporters. I think we're very strong supporters of the Palestinian cause. And one final thing, he spoke about the green climate, and I agree that we have to deal with climate change. But they supported Bolsonaro
in Brazil
for 10 years, who has completely destroyed the rainforest. And you're asking where the press...
I'm just wondering, because the press, when they tried to get in, you could hear them all just going, and what about the Pentagon leaks? And what about, you know, your new campaign? And they were sort of flown off into the wind.
But I think the only opportunity we get, should be... I don't agree. I don't think he was going to come into the Dáil and take questions. I think that was a bit ridiculous.
So the boycott in that respect, I want to bring in the American...
But I think the press... He should have not a press conference.
Let's bring in the American, because do we give... do we give the US a bit of a free pass on maybe the broader external policy issues, or perhaps even its internal issues, because of because of the history, the culture, but also because of the extent of the economic relationship?
Yeah.
What did you think of the visit?
Well, I thought it was a success. I think Joe Biden's presidency has been very successful. I think that he does get a free pass. He got one this week. The press were effectively, and in respect to the people in the press, a group who were almost like collective lickspittle towards him. So,
Like, what did he have for breakfast this morning?
No, but if, for instance, if Donald Trump came here, you know, when you say, how would you protest that? People would have found a way. If you found a way to you know, look at the things that, that John has spoken about, people would have found a way.
But the people didn't want to find a way, otherwise they would have been protesting.
Well, no, but they didn't, because there's this fawning love towards Democratic presidents. I'll put it this way. I'm a staunchly patriotic American, and I mean that to the point of no return. Every president I love, I don't care what side they're on. And so for that reason, I think Joe Biden is also great. He has had a lot of failures in his presidency. No one ever talks about them. And if you look at, for instance, when he said, oh, I have a cousin of mine and he beat the black and tans. If that was Trump, it would have been just boom. Look at this man.
Did you read the British press? Did you read the British press on that one?
But this is the point. The British were applying the same razor towards his presidency with consistency.
Certain sections of the British press were applying.
But the Irish press, carte blanche, you couldn't find a bad word said about him. Yeah. And I think that has to do with this relic fawning adoration towards JFK, that ever since then, all Democrats are good, all Republicans are bad.
But Louise Biden's Byrne, I don't know if you're a lady, certainly. I don't know if you're fawning. But look, I mean, the links are substantive. You know, look, I mean, one of the things that Joe Biden did was coming in, was on the, you know, what is overlooked, perhaps, is that it was also coming in the week of the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, of which the US was critical. But do you agree that the Irish press, that you and your colleagues were fawning over him?
I think,
or did you just not get a chance to not fawn?
Oh yeah, I don't necessarily think that's fair. I think it's fair in one way, but in another way, we didn't get a chance to get near him. We didn't get a chance to ask him any questions.
No one controlled what you wrote, though.
So. No one controlled what we wrote, but when you're only presented with one thing, and like I was sent to cover events in Ballina, well, then that's all you can do. Like, we didn't have access to him. Perhaps there could have been more critical coverage. Perhaps you're right. But I think in the week that it was a positive thing for Ireland. It was something.
People get caught up in the positivity.
People do get caught up in the positivity. But I suppose when, like, it's hard as well when that's all you're presented with and you've no means to challenge it.
No column inches where you could have said, by the way, contrast this with, or like, you know, black and tans versus the all blacks.
I just want to bring it in there, because the security bill, I think one of the papers has it, 50 million.
Yeah.
That must be money well spent compared to the coverage that the island of Ireland got this week, including those stunning pictures of the light show at Ballina Cathedral. And it was... Even from a domestic point of view in the US, it was a success for him.
Yeah, no, there's two sides to this. You know, as already been pointed out, you know, there's the lack of policy in the visit, and you know, the purpose of the visit was clearly a start to his campaign, his election campaign for Biden. But for us, I mean,
is that entirely true? When you look at those very, very emotive pictures standing outside that hospice,
absolutely,
with his family,
clearly a personal element to it for him. But if you think about, you know, for a personal visit, as the Shane Ross piece points out, you know, for a personal visit, he had very few personal moments. It was all very public. So, you know, you had the appeal to the Irish Americans, but you also had the appeal to, say, the Hispanics, you know, the Catholic Hispanics in the US who have been moving away from the Democrats as well. And you also had this reminder to the world of the US involvement in the Northern Ireland peace process.
Which does no harm when
which
you're
is
out
really,
trying to
exactly,
repair your reputation.
Absolutely. So there was a lot of very strategic elements to his visit on the US side. On our side, it's invaluable, that soft power and that access to one of the most powerful leaders
in the world.
Can I ask
you though,
because
one of the things that it has done, I suppose, is make us reappraise the relationship. But one of them, which is incontestable, is the economic relationship, which both governments insist is a two-way street,
well,
not just a one-way street. But when you look at the related coverage, just in relation to vulnerabilities around our tax take and the reliance on a small number of multinationals.
A small number of multinationals, and the front of the Business Post today is pointing out that now Apple and Microsoft make up a third of our of our corporate tax receipts. So, you know, even when we do increase that tax rate to the 15%, that is unlikely to have a huge impact on that.
And
but we're so vulnerable to it. You know, one of those
I think we're potentially vulnerable to any
you
changes.
You call it vulnerability. Yeah. It's actually because we punch above our weight internationally. Ireland is an amazing success story in attracting foreign direct investment. There's literally almost no other country in the world that has done it to the degree
we do. But one, Carl, that could be very, very vulnerable to changes in US domestic politics, which we might continue this chat, because you've been talking too much and I need to take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back, and you're all very, very taxed about that tax item. One listener says, I worked for an Irish PLC and the fear of reputational damage by being named was the number one thing that ensured extreme rigour in tax compliance. Another says, who would kid in Derville? The defaulters list is now almost a badge of honour. For certain individuals. On Biden, some of you agree, some say Biden was given a free pass to play up to the Irish to influence the Irish vote in the next election. Another says, as someone originally from Dundalk, I was proud to see our town and its hinterland feature on international news for all the right reasons, a region that has been unfairly maligned in the past. Well, my mummy was from Dundalk and I couldn't agree more. It was great to see the Louth looking so well on the town on that one. Louise, I'm going to come to you next on quite a number of stories in the paper this morning on the RTE director general. She can take through some of them there.
Yeah, so I think perhaps the biggest one is page 3 of the Sunday Business Post by John Walsh. Mostly opinion pieces. Is it actually worth pointing out on the kind of what's happening with the Director General post in RTE? So John Walsh on page 3 of the Business Post, he says, selection of new national media chief descends into an utter farce. And this has obviously been written about quite a lot over the last couple of weeks. And Dee Forbes is stepping down from her role in July and they're trying to find a successor. Now, it had been assumed that Dave McGredmond, currently of Unpussed, would get the role. It's been written that perhaps he didn't get through the first interview stage. Another name that is being mentioned is John Bathurst, and he was assumed that he would get it. He was put forward by three members of the RTE board, including chairperson Shuni Rally. There was supposedly disagreements about the coverage and the amount of leaks. So that meeting to appoint him, leaks, and it is leaks, and it is people unhappy with the amount of leaks. So that didn't go very well. And I think John Walsh was saying that both men deserve better than the kind of what he describes as a farce.
When you're going for a job, I think it should be noted that the board is RTE is a government appointed board. I think there's only one RTE appointed staff member. But of course, with the Oireachtas hearings on Wednesday, we will be hearing much more on this later this week. I want to move on, John Halligan, to housing, because there's not a week goes by that it is not dominating our coverage. Fine Gael Fiarra, Leo's housing blunder. It's John Drennan and John Lee in the Mail on Sunday. What are they saying about the impact with these latest polls?
Actually, if I could just jump a little ahead, there's a great article, I think, in The Independent by Wayne O'Connor, and he's talking about the hidden homeless that hasn't been discussed a lot here in Ireland.
Is this the people couch surfing or not quite in official homeless?
Like, you're defined as being homeless if you're in a shelter, or you present yourself as homeless. But there's a huge spray of people out there. I think there's about 12 or 13,000 people presenting themselves as homeless. But I'd say you could triple that. I know for a fact in my own constituency in Waterford and the surrounding areas, there are people living with their mothers and fathers. In other words, you don't have a key to your own home. They're staying with friends and they're homeless. And
or they're back living with parents in their 40s and older.
Which is horrible. And they have no chance of a house. If you're a single person, a single parent or a single person, you're 4 or 5 years, 6 years, so you're out of it. Now, the interesting point here is that I believe that Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party have put themselves behind history in the decision to do away with the eviction ban with nothing in place. Could the eviction ban have been kept in place indefinitely? No. I don't think so either, and I agree with that. But we're at a situation here now where all you've got to do is put on any television programme, any radio programme, yourselves, RT, Live at 5 yesterday or Friday, I think, where we have people coming on distressed and in a terrible state where they've already gotten their eviction notices. The problem here is that it's all very well to lift the eviction ban and say, look, it couldn't last, and it could not. I accept that. But what you are going to do...
We weren't getting good... What to do instead?
Exactly. When will you find it? Let's just specifically talk about what you're suggesting.
I think some of what the government have put in place are not even in place at present. But they haven't reached their targets with houses that they were public houses they were to build. They were to bring in legislation to deal with new planning laws to quicken up planning applications. They haven't done that. Surely all of this should have been put in place before they put thousands of people out on the road. It's an interesting story.
Would that have been achieved within 6 months? Let's say we were having this debate again in January.
But it's interesting here that there was a lady on RT yesterday who's working she's able to pay 2,000 rent a month, which is huge in Dublin. She's out today, Sunday, out on the street with her two children. And she was able to present hundreds of applicants to places she tried to get a house, tried to get accommodation. Look at what's happening in Dublin.
Because, of course, Carla, it is capturing, you know, we discussed it before, the no-fault eviction bans as well. What would you have done, Carla? Too soon.
Lifted it too soon.
Look, saying that a policy is a bad idea doesn't mean that I have an answer to what instead, because it implies that for everything that occurs, you have to have a policy intervention. Okay, so that's what I'm not saying. The eviction ban was bad policy, badly done, badly thought out. It had massive negative implications. It actually brought forward evictions that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And there's also been a lack of investment or a cause for investment for regular people, because we set up a taxation that treated, you know, large companies buying lots of homes very differently than, say, your indigenous mom and pop investor who used to make up a large part of the landlords.
And many of whom have left.
And they're being given reasons to leave. Like, we've never actually asked the question that if rents are so high and prices are so good, why is everybody running away from this? They're doing the exact opposite of what you think they would be doing. We see that regulation, the same article that John refers to, right beside it, it says a lack of small apartments is a large part of the problem. But we actually kicked out about 10,000 pre-63 homes over 10 years ago. And everyone cheered at the time because it was the end of slum style living. But those were appropriate homes for low income people at certain times in their life. And we never looked at the implications of it. So the continued intervention has a knock on effect somewhere. We cheer and applaud ourselves that we're so righteous thinking. We did the right thing by ending evictions. You didn't end them. It's like damming a river and thinking the water goes away.
Can I bring you in, Louise Byrne, just on the problems, the polls, and look, I mean, what John Brennan and John Lee have in the lead in the Irish Mail on Sunday, is that something that you have been hearing, kind of discontent amongst the Fine Gael rank and file with Leo Varadkar over the handling of the housing issue?
Yeah, and I think it is finally coming home to roost in Fine Gael that housing is going to be what makes or breaks the next election and the next government. And I think it's been a realisation that's been a long time coming, but I think people in Fine Gael are beginning to get that and beginning to understand.
They were beginning to understand it before now.
I don't think so. And I genuinely think that the stuff like the ending of the eviction ban, the anger over that, I think it's really beginning to hit home how serious of an issue this is. And I think it was quite interesting from the John Drennan and John Lee in the Mail, they were saying that, you know, perhaps these polls aren't a problem right now, but if they get much further, well, then is it going to have to push? We're starting to look like Eamon Gilmore's Labour, and I presume that means that they're heading for a complete and utter wipeout in the poll. So I think Fine Gael are beginning to panic a little bit. I think the one thing going in Fine Gael's favour is that perhaps it's not a Fine Gael housing minister in there, and they can try and turn that around on Fianna Fáil, on Dara O'Brien. Well, their track record, they can't really blame that on anyone else, but if, you know, come the next election, if housing for all doesn't work, you can say, well, you'd have Fianna Fáil housing minister in there for however long. And I mean, we see that already. One senior Fine Gael source saying to the paper that the housing minister has neither the aptitude nor the work ethic to deal with housing and in an adequate way. And I mean, I think that's quite damning 2 years out from an election.
You could say that about any housing minister since we've had them, though. I mean, you can absolutely put these claims upon any politician. But the fact is that they have come up with plans. There has been huge amounts of money spent. There's been massive progress. A lot of it fought hard against, such as strategic housing developments, where it ends up in the courts and being delayed. You've got to look at housing with the fierce frustration of understanding that even the best laid plans tend to fall apart. And this is being replicated, by the way, in almost every country that is successful in the whole world. I study the international markets extensively in housing, and this is such a common problem.
We're certainly not the only jurisdiction that's dealing with it. But can I ask Emma, can I bring you in there? It's, you know, every Sunday when you sit down with the paper, every day actually, it's not the single stories on housing that count. It's actually the totality of it. I even think there was a piece in the Business Post today just about how the state itself could be leveraging the land development agency because of land hoarding. And it is all of those stories. But even with the eviction ban, of course, there's a lot of anger and protest, but there's a lot of people who are homeowners who want to be able to deal with their property, who want, you know, there's no
quick fix is the problem. It is a systemic problem. It is a huge lack of supply in housing, and they aren't going to be able to do anything substantial before the next general election is the thing. I mean, the eviction ban ending, you know, there's a balancing of rights there. There's a trade-off. So we know that there are a lot of landlords exiting the market. Now, the extent to which that is purely down to regulation is questionable because
they could just be coming to the end of the period of their investment.
During the 2000s, you know, people were very much encouraged to invest in housing, and now that's beginning to wind down a bit. So people are reaching retirement age and want to sell their properties and so on. There was a National Economic and Social Council report that actually asked landlords who were exiting why they were exiting. 55% of them said they just didn't want to be landlords anymore.
And John, can I just ask you?
There's a big part of that.
It feeds into one of the bigger stories, which is: should we go like London? Do we need an alliance for teachers in Dublin? Do we need alliances for key workers, even perhaps because of the cost of?
Yeah, just very briefly, I think it's important to say this, and you're correct in what you're saying. The Landlords Association issued a statement a few weeks ago to say that lifting the eviction ban wasn't a big issue with them. I think it was third or fourth down the list. It was a tax and wanted to sell their properties, right? We only started to do development plans in local areas about 20 years ago, where they were doing them in Europe 40, 50 years ago, which was laying out plans for building social housing, affordable housing and so on. We left developers run right with the cost of buildings. We left builders run right. And we've done this for 20, 30 years. Now it's coming home to roost where you can't buy a house. Like someone on, if you get a mortgage, I think it's four times what you earn. If you're earning 80,000, your mortgage is capped, I think, at about 300,000. You can't buy a house in Dublin for that. So all of that. But to lead on, I've forgotten what you said to me now. I've got carried away.
The Dublin allowance.
This is what they get for not giving me enough tea in the morning.
It's interesting that if you look at, I was reading an article during the week there where young teachers are exiting the teaching profession and many of them that are qualified in Dublin are leaving Dublin because they can't get accommodation.
Emma, or Louise, I want to just bring you in this. Look, I mean, a lot of our parents, their social mobility, their wealth came from starting out in social housing, maybe being able to buy it, or in some case, being able to move on. You're still at home with your mummy.
I am still at home with my mummy.
Your lovely mummy.
My lovely, I better behave now. I won't get me dinner later. Now, listen, and when I think, like, I'm 28, and when I think back to probably my parents and my friends' parents, they were probably buying their houses at this stage, settling down. And they were well settled, whereas I feel like myself and my friends were either living at home or renting, spending huge amounts of money.
And if you're renting, you can't save.
And this is it. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm still at home is because I had to make that decision. Do I go? Do I stay? Do I save? And that's the decision I have made. And that's hard in and of itself. But I mean, I think my generation, I think housing is going to be the big thing for years to come. And I think I hear a lot of people saying, I don't think I'll ever own a house. And I think that's really unfortunate. And a lot of people have gone into that mindset. I hope that's not the case. I'm still holding on to that little bit of hope that one day I will own a house. But I think the government, we hear so often, oh, we're turning a corner, we're on the cusp of change. I think we heard Leo Varadkar saying that house prices have fallen in January. Any other time you hear 1 month of data, you're going, you can't base anything on 1 month of data. It's just one poll. You can't base anything on this and everything else.
Prices are starting to really moderate.
I don't think people are seeing it.
European average, way below.
And also the other important point is that rents are not equalising.
Exactly.
So if you look at what's happening with house prices versus income and rents versus income, so you're stuck in a rental trap. So if you're fortunate enough and you've got a parent who can take you in and you can live with someone,
can something personal, are you a landlord? Would you consider leaving the market? Are you?
Yeah, I make no secret about me working in the landlord trade as well. I think there's
is it
reason,
less attractive?
Pardon?
Is it less attractive?
The way that things are going, I kind of, the headache that goes with it, I think it's beyond what it, okay, look, I'll just put
What's
out some
headache?
Numbers. So the headache is this, because of the way the taxation works, my mortgage costs 1500 because of the way that rent fixing works or rent controls work, the rent is about the same. And you say to yourself, oh, so you're breaking even, but then you've got your insurance, you've got costs, you've got property tax, but then you've also got another tax bill because as you pay down a mortgage, you can only look at offsetting the interest. And for a while, you couldn't even offset the interest. Like if I started up a Mystic Meg chat line and I spent money on something,
oh,
I could offset
Carl.
The... okay, but I'm just saying like everyone else was allowed to do it, but you couldn't as a landlord. So now I've got another kind of 400 and some odd euro tax bill as well. I've got three young kids and I'm saying to myself, Like, if the next door neighbour rented out their property tomorrow, they'd be getting 2,300. Why am I stuck in this situation? There was never never a way to make it fair.
Although for a long time it was a very, very sound investment. But I'm going to have to take
It wasn't sound when you were you know, at risk of getting repossessed. It wasn't sound when you were at 100 grand underwater. So, I mean, the whole narrative around this is quite broken when it comes down to the facts. Yeah. And the first-time buyers have help to buy. They have the home equity scheme. You've got the CREE scheme. Like, there's never been more help for first-time buyers too. So I think it needs to have a rational...
If you qualify for them, how are you going to qualify sometimes for a brand new house? The cost of a brand new house is extortionate.
Absolutely.
And, like, it has to be a brand new house to get the help to buy scheme. And
perhaps you can't be returning from abroad because you have to have paid
your tax. It swings and roundabouts at all of these things. It's never as simple as it looks.
It's never as simple as it looks. Thank you, Louise Byrne. Let's take a very, very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Well, very welcome back. One listener says, I'm a landlord and after 20 plus years, I am out. All sold off, bar one, and that's going this year. No more. Government broke this. Not my job to fix it. I want to move on to yesterday. The Citizens Assembly had its first public session. I actually had the privilege of moderating the session on people's personal experience of using drugs, and it was very, very powerful. But it was not John Halligan without the birth of this assembly was not without its controversy.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy apparently over the last number of weeks. Letters going from those that each accusing the other side of negatively given misinformation. And the objective of the Citizens Assembly when it was set up was to be a neutral group of people. Otherwise, what is the point? And there's a lot of criticism from some TDs that Mary Cannon, who is a psychiatrist and who has publicly spoke out against liberalisation of drug laws and drug use. And I'm disappointed to hear that. I didn't think that was
that
the case.
That she was on the advisory group.
Yes, she was on the advisory group.
But John Halligan, there are other people in that advisory group, including someone we heard a lot from yesterday, including on Saturday with Colm Mungoyne, Philly McMahon,
yes,
whose brother, tragically, John died from heroin addiction back in 2012. And he would have very, very strong views in the opposite direction. Emma Howard, is it just that you might have your views, but you just have to make sure that they don't...
Well, and I also think, you know, as an expert, as a psychiatrist, she has a wealth of knowledge from experience and from her profession. And so having campaigned or having formed an opinion based on that expertise is very different, for example, than having somebody who has financial interest in the legalization of drugs. You know, so that article in the Sunday Times. So, you know, they interviewed a number of experts over the blazing row. And one of them was, you know, Dr. Ray Wally, Peter Reynolds, who's a spokesperson for the Cannabis Industry Council. You know, so there's different types of experts, and to say that she's neutral in terms of she isn't financially benefiting from it, she's using her expertise is quite different.
Carl, there is a lot of discussion around, there's a lot of confusing terms, legalisation, regulation, criminalisation, decriminalisation, but you actually lived beside a drug clinic for a period of time.
Well, I would have spent, you know, my 12-hour work days beside a drug clinic on Pier Street for 12 years. So I kind of used to just think about drugs like whatever, you know, people take them. I used to take them when I was a kid. You know, you make your choices. But having seen actual, you know, desperate heroin addicts and watching people intravenously take drugs every day. Like, any time we went out the back, there was someone injecting drugs. Anytime you wanted to move your car, because there was a laneway behind my work, constantly people out of their head on drugs, taking drugs, selling drugs, doing other things in order to get drugs. And it really made me rethink of it. And I started to say, like, see it, like, this is like a health crisis. Like, the illegality of it never made a difference. The fact that in the prison system in certain places, you can buy drugs shows that prohibition never works. It is the longest running and most failed war that we've ever had. Equally, prohibition creates the crime that is so awful. Like, prohibition created Al Capone. Alcohol became illegal. Al Capone went from being a pimp to being a kingpin. Prohibition creates the Kinahan cartel. So, like, I can't even go in and buy two packs of paracetamol and Spar.
Actually, Emma, there was a piece, because obviously the
links into the codeine.
The Citizens Assembly obviously is dealing with you know, since Assembly is dealing with illicit drugs and defined in legislation, but, you know, there was a piece I think you spotted, was it?
Yeah, so on page coding. 2 of the Sunday Times, so linked to the Citizens Assembly, which is on our codeine overuse problem in Ireland. So there's an Oxford study recently that found that out of 31 countries that they looked at, we had the second highest use of codeine drugs out of all those countries. And so now there is a discussion, and Primetime had internal documents from the HSE as to whether or not we should make them prescription. So, you know, it's...
Although you do get interrogated an awful lot if you do ask Louise for some types of codeine products if you go to a pharmacy.
Sometimes. There was a Primetime documentary, I want to say last year, that showed that not all pharmacies are following those questions that you have to answer when you go into the pharmacy, supposedly. Yeah. But I mean, I think like anything, and it's kind of like what Carl said, regulation just makes things more appealing in some ways. So there is a fine line that you have to
And yet the criminal law probably has to have a role somewhere, but I can't get into that right now because we're coming up to 12 o'clock and it's going to be time for the news. For now, I want to thank Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin, Louise Byrne, political correspondent at the Irish Mirror, Carl Dieter, financial analyst, and John Halligan, former independent TD for Waterford and Minister. It's just coming up to 12 o'clock. Let's go to Susan Jackson in the newsroom.